Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Features, the program that deals with issues of our listeners in our community. Today we're dealing with our Great Lakes water basin. And that goes all the way from Minnesota to Lake Ontario, a huge, one of the largest bodies of fresh water in the world. And today I have Dr. Mark Gaydon of the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
I've enjoyed what I've learned so far and looking forward to sharing it and learning more myself. Let's pause for a moment of prayer. Our great Heavenly Father, we just want to thank you that we are stewards and that we need to be responsible, and we can do something to take care of our bodies of water, that our drinking water, our recreation, and some of our industry and economy. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Mark, what is the Great Lakes Fishery Commission? How did it come into existence?
We are a binational commission, and we were set up jointly in 1956 by the governments of Canada and the United States, because the international border goes through four of the five Great Lakes, and therefore, if we want to take action to preserve and protect and restore and also improve the Great Lakes fishery, we need to work together. We had too much of our history where we didn't do that, and the fishery suffered quite badly, not only the fish themselves, but the people who fished the Great Lakes and depended on the Great Lakes fisheries for their livelihood or for food, and so on. And we realized finally by the 1950s that if we didn't work together, we really would have no fishery to speak of. So that's what the Great Lakes Fishery Commission is. It's the commitment at the highest levels of Canada and the United States to work together for this wonderful resource that amounts to about 30% of the fresh water that's on the planet.
Absolutely. Now, Dr. Mark, you might want to help our listeners to say, well, I don't fish. You know, what is this to me? What is this to our listeners as a whole? How does the fish in these Great Lakes affect me?
Fisheries have been part of our history since time immemorial, whether it's Native Americans and Native Canadians who were fishing the Great Lakes, or Europeans who settled the region. Fish drew people to the Great Lakes. There were advertisements, for example, in early magazine newspapers that would say, come to Toronto, and not only do you have access to lots of farmland, but also nearly inexhaustible fishery resources. What that means is that over time, since the 1700s or even earlier, as people settled the region and as cities grew, as villages grew, fish and fishing and all the benefits that fish brought has always been a part of our fabric. It's been very deeply ingrained in the culture of this region. So you'll see communities throughout the Great Lakes Basin, even to this day, that are very centered on fishing. Some of them commercial fishing, some of them indigenous fishing, some of them recreational fishing. It's just part of this region. And if you don't fish directly, you might benefit economically from the side effects of that, like tourism and the restaurants and gasoline for boats and boats themselves and the like. So it is part of our economy, too. And then there are a lot of people who just like knowing that there is a healthy Great Lakes out there, whether you're doing it for fishing or for boating or for canoeing or swimming. They care about the fact that the Great Lakes are vibrant. And again, fishery is just very much a part of our fabric.
You know, Mark, I heard that there was a day when maybe fishing kind of, the Great Lakes were not as good as they are today, and maybe they were even better. I'm wondering, can the experience with the timber industry give us some guidance? And you say, well, that's on land and once on fish, but it was said once that Michigan had endless supply of lumber, and we had 500 years. That was in the 1800s, and that lasts barely 100 years. Did that happen likewise with fish? There was endless amount of fish. You could never fish out all the fish in Lake Michigan or the Great Lakes?
That concept of fish being an endless supply and inexhaustible was very much a part of certainly the early commercial fishing mindset in the 1800s. And it was recognized by about the 1890s that was just a fallacy. And yet there was very little will of Canada or the United States to take action to stop that from happening. So yes, there was very much this idea that our natural resources were inexhaustible, whether it was lumber or fish or even the quality of the drinking water. There were people that would believe that how is it possible you could pollute the Great Lakes and a resource this big? People got their drinking water from it, and it was just inconceivable. And yet by even the 1890s, you had people in Chicago becoming very, very sick because all the nasty things that was put into the Chicago River was put right into Lake Michigan, which was a source of drinking water. You had the same thing with Detroit and any other big city, Cleveland, Buffalo, Milwaukee, this idea that the Great Lakes were just too big to pollute or the fish were too plentiful to exhaust. What happened is that the fishing gear by the 1890s became overly lethal. There were no regulations or very few regulations that was constraining the behavior. And what would happen is that you would maybe exhaust one particular fish species and just move on to another. The scientists and the policymakers were sounding the alarm by 1897 about the state of that fishery. Not much changed in the 1920s, in the 1930s, and 1940s. And there was another binational report in the 1940s that drew almost the same conclusions as the 1890s. So we weren't making much progress in the first half of the 20th century, that's for sure.
And so it was, we were getting nowhere. There was people on all sides, different stakeholders, different interests. But there was something that happened that precipitated, and all of a sudden everybody says, we have to start working together. What was that?
Well, it was an invasive species that oddly united the folks in Canada and the United States to really come together against a common problem. This is called the sea lamprey, and if you search on it online, you'll get a sense of just how horrific this invader was. It even looks horrific. It's a snake-like fish. It's cartilaginous, so there's no bones. It's like a shark, but the mouth is a round disc that's ringed with sharp teeth, and in the middle is a file-like tongue that flicks out. And the disc, the mouth, is a suction cup. It's a very strong suction cup. It grabs onto the side of the fish. The teeth anchor on the side of the fish, and then the tongue drills through the scales and skin, and it'll feed on fish's blood and body fluids until the fish dies, and then it moves on to another. In its native range, which is the Atlantic Ocean, they're part of the ecosystem there. And the predator-prey balance is like it sounds. It's in balance. In the Great Lakes, they're not native, and the fish here don't have a fighting chance against them. And the lamprey, sea lamprey, had the ability of just like a plague of locusts wiping out the fishery and causing significant damage to them. They swam their way into the Great Lakes through shipping canals. The first was in the 1800s through the Erie Canal, invaded the Finger Lakes of New York and also Lake Ontario, and they were causing havoc as early as the 1850s in Lake Ontario. And then when the Canadians rebuilt the Welland Canal, that's a canal that bypasses Niagara Falls, the lamprey got into Lake Erie, first seen in 1921, first seen in Lake Michigan in 1936, first seen in Lake Huron in 1937. And that was obviously first seen because they swam through Lake Huron first. And then first seen in Lake Superior in 1939. So the invasion was pretty complete by 1940.
So you could see it. You could see it coming.
They knew it. I mean, when they first saw it in Lake Erie in 1921, there were some scientists that had charted what they did to the Finger Lakes and the Lake Ontario, and they're like, "Well, you got them, and beware." And the Lake Erie is not the best habitat, so it took a while for the lamprey to make their way from Lake Erie through Lake St. Clair up to Lake Huron. But once they made it into Lakes Michigan and Huron, the cat was out of the bag, and folks knew what was coming. We interviewed for a history project some very old-timer commercial fishers of the Great Lakes. And one, for example, that was particularly pointed, this was Western Lake Superior, remembered getting seeing a letter from his father, who was off fishing Isle Royal, and seeing his mother very, very upset reading the letter. And the letter basically said the lamprey had come and made it to Isle Royal. And these people knew what that meant. It was not good. And the lamprey, in not so slow motion, really did devastate the Great Lakes fishery and was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back after decades and decades of overfishing, overly lethal fishing gear, demand that was sending lots and lots of fish off to markets farther and farther away as refrigeration became more common. And the lamprey was just something that it's like, if we don't deal with this problem, it is truly existential.
What percentage of the fisheries, I mean, did it drop by a quarter? I mean, first of all, they're disgusting to look at. I mean, just make you cringe when you look at them hanging off the side of a fish, but how big of impact did they have on the fisheries?
It was a tremendous impact. It was terrible. Each lamprey will kill about 40 pounds of fish. And when they have nearly unlimited spawning habitat, which they do in the Great Lakes, and no predators, which they do in the Great Lakes, and no discrimination over the fish that they like, they'll eat anything. The impact on not just large quantities of fish, but also a variety, the range of species, was pretty tremendous. To put it in perspective, at one point before lampreys were started to be brought under control, they were killing about five times the commercial catch in the upper lakes of lake trout, a prized species in the Great Lakes. So they were killing far more fish than humans were harvesting in their commercial fisheries.
So they were out fishing the fishermen?
By an order of magnitude, yes, they were out fishing the fishermen. And I should say, by the way, up until about the 1950s, the fishery was composed primarily of commercial fishing and indigenous fishing. The recreational fishery did exist, but it was relatively small until after, say, World War II, when people began to have more disposable income and more time and a greater appreciation for leisure and getting to the outdoors. So we had up until really the main movers and shakers were the commercial fishing industry. And then as the 20th century kind of reached its midpoint, you had the commercial fishing industry and the recreational fishers largely affected by this very, very destructive, noxious, invasive species.
The sea lampreys are not the only invasive species. Today we're familiar with the zebra mussel, but as I was growing up, there was the alewives. I mean, there was a certain time in June that they all died off. It was a horrendous experience, the beach experience. People just evacuated the beaches and nobody knew what to do. Tell us a little bit of that story.
I'm glad you brought the alewife up because it is part of the story. The alewife is an invasive species as well. It's not native to the Great Lakes. And they're a kind of a small, mid-sized herring-like species. And they are not very well suited for the Great Lakes environment. They're like just right on the edge. So you get a good cold winter or something and they won't make it all that well. And so the alewife is just kind of were kind of in the Great Lakes and not all that well suited to the habitat. Not a huge problem in the early part of the 20th century because there were fish in the lakes that would eat them. So they're a prey fish, which means that they're on the losing end of the food web, you know, the small fish that gets eaten by the bigger fish. And so you get like the lake trout and burbot, the Atlantic salmon in Lake Ontario, those types of fish that are piscivores or fish that eat fish would keep the alewife in check for the most part. What happened, however, is that when the lamprey came into the Great Lakes, they wiped out the top predator fish, like the native trout and salmon that were at the top of the food web. And the lamprey didn't go after alewives because they're, you know, not worth it to a lamprey. And so you had the alewives then not being kept in check. And a huge upset in the predator-prey balance that is part of a healthy functioning system. So you had an invasive species that wiped out the native species that was keeping another invasive species in check. And what happened? Well, you would have massive die-offs of alewives because there were just too many of them for the ecosystem to support. And as you said, you would have these situations where, as far as the eye could see, there would be dead alewives on the beaches and these windrows, stinking, smelling masses in the hundreds of thousands of that. It kept people away from the Great Lakes. People turned their backs to the lakes. This would be in the 1950s where we had this odd thing where people wanted to get out into the outdoors and they had the money and the time to do it. And yet the Great Lakes were worsening in their condition, leading toward just total catastrophe by, 1970, where you had pollution rampant and rivers burning and the like. Alewives were a part of that. They would bury the alewives with backhoes on beaches because they needed to do something with them. So the lamprey and the alewives have a sort of an inglorious connection in the Great Lakes ecosystem. And the good news is that lamprey control leads to the conditions that also led to dealing with the alewife problem.
Wow.
But we have about 180 non-native species in the Great Lakes. A good 2-3 dozen of them are really, really harmful. Some of them were introduced on purpose, the non-native species like some of the Chinook salmon, coho salmon, steelhead, brown trout. Those are all not native, but they were brought in to serve a fishery. But the invasive species that are there and a problem, we can only control two of them. We can control the sea lamprey and we can control the alewife. The alewife is controlled by stocking predator fish like the salmon that will eat them and trout. And the lamprey is controlled by a couple of control techniques that we can talk about.
Yeah, let's go there right now.
Yeah. Well, the very first thing when scientists were trying to get a handle on what the sea lamprey problem meant was understanding their life cycle. And they have a pretty unique life cycle. And it turns out that they're vulnerable in a couple of places of their life cycle. So since it's a cycle, I'm just going to start at the spawning phase. They spawn in streams, and they spawn once and they die. So that's not uncommon in some species where they're just a single spawning run and they would die naturally. They move into streams to spawn. They build nests out of rocks. They literally grab onto the rock and drag it into a crescent-shaped nest. Their scientific name is Petromyzon marinus, which means stone sucker. And they literally do grab onto the stones and move them to create that nest. When the eggs hatch, the larvae burrow, or they drift downstream, and they burrow into kind of soft, mucky areas of a river. And they live as a worm-like larvae, harmlessly, for 3-4 years in the river bottoms. So if you're out in a stream that has a lamprey in it, you should know that there are probably lots of larvae living in the river bottoms. And they're feeding on whatever drifts by, you know, like decayed leaves or whatever. And then when the time is right, the lamprey will emerge from the river bottoms. They'll grow that grotesque, lethal mouth, go out into the lake, and spend the next year to a year and a half slaughtering the fish. When they've had their fill and they are ready to spawn, they move into the streams and spawn again. What the scientists said is that you're not going to get the lamprey out in the lake because you're, you know, they're just out there. And so you're not going to catch enough of them to deal with the problem. So why not target them either in that spawning phase or that larval phase where they're living in the river bottoms? The focus for a while was like physical structures, like mechanical weirs or small dams that would, maybe even involving electricity that would stop the lamprey. Those didn't prove all that effective. So the scientists turned toward finding something that would kill the larvae and not harm fish. It's really easy to kill fish, but it's really, really hard to target the species that are harmful and that you want to remove. And that's what they focused on. They tested about 10,000 different things until they found a pesticide that was selective to the lamprey and didn't harm fish. And it had to also break down in the environment quickly. And they actually discovered it. They did a really, really intense effort starting in 1950. And by 1957, they had discovered this miraculous substance that would prove to eventually save the Great Lakes fishery.
Wonderful. So how's the progress being made right now?
Well, the progress has been phenomenal. The first treatments with that lamprecide were done in Lake Superior in 1959. And the way the life cycle is that the survivors of a treatment will, and there's not many, but they're, you know, let's just say maybe 5% of the lamprey will survive a treatment. It's usually much less than that. But those will go out into the lake and spend the next year and a half killing fish and then move into the streams to spawn. So if you do a treatment, say, in 1960, you're not going to know its effect until 1962 when you can get a sense of how many came back to spawn. So they were on pins and needles in the late 1950s when they were trying this, because in the lab, at least, you had something that killed the lamprey and didn't harm the fish and was out of the, like, completely dissolved in a matter of hours. So the lamprecide was photodegradable. So they started doing the treatments in the late 1950s, and really it wasn't until 1962 until they had enough data back to know if it was effective or not. And it was. They were, you know, the spawning run dropped by several fold between 1961 and 1962, so they knew it was working. We expanded then the lamprey control program slowly to the other Great Lakes, with the Lake Erie finally being brought online in the 1980s. And the lamprey numbers have been going down quite steadily, right after we come in and start the treatments. There are species that fluctuate, so sometimes we'll get a spike and sometimes we'll get a big dip. But the one thing we do know is that this lamprecide is very effective, and it has reduced the populations by about 90 to 95% from the days when they were killing, you know, five times the commercial catch. So we've really come a long way since 1958 when we started the lamprey control program.
So this is at a manageable level, or are we acceptable, or are we still driving down to a lower level of lamprey population?
Yeah, what we do is we set targets for the lake. So there's a certain level where spending more money on lamprey control just isn't worth it.
Right.
Where you're far exceeding the value of the fishery. So there's a certain target, and the targets are different in each lake because it's, you know, what's possible. So in the Great Lakes right now, before the disruption that COVID caused. We were out in at Target close to everywhere in the Great Lakes Basin, a little higher in Lake Superior because there's a lot of food for fish. There's a lot of fish in Lake Superior, and the lamprey just help themselves to the buffet. So if they have a lot of food, they are liable to thrive more. We had a pause in the treatments because of the travel restrictions in 2020 and 2021. And so in 2022, you would see the survivors of the shortened 2020 season. And then in 2023, you saw the survivors of the shortened 2021 season because of that cycle I talked about. And lo and behold, we did see a spike in the lamprey numbers. These are slimy, opportunistic beasts that take advantage of any relaxation and control. Each female could have 100,000 eggs. And yeah, I know. So, you know, even the 2 to 5% that survive a treatment is enough to make the next generation. If the treatments are relaxed, you just have a lot more that are contributing to the next generation. And that's what we saw. But the good news is we're not scratching our heads wondering how to deal with the problem.
Mark, what can our listeners do? Do we stand back and say we're in the stadium and hooray for the people who are doing this? Is there anything we can do?
I think that there is. I have deep respect for the people who do the Lamprey Control Program because they are motivated by their stewardship responsibility for the Great Lakes fishery to protect the fish that are in the system and to support the economies of the local communities that depend on the fishery. So I salute them, and they take their job very seriously, and they save the Great Lakes fishery. It's now valued at about $6 billion, so it's worth the effort. The other thing that I would do is urge people, if you come into contact with your elected representatives in Congress, to remind them that this is a worthwhile endeavor. It is a $6 billion fishery, and what this work does is it protects that. It's a very, very small price. It's about $20 million a year, borne by Canada and the United States, that gives us a $6 billion fishery. And the elected representatives, it's one of the things that there's complete agreement on in Washington. It's not much, but this is one of them. That lamprey are bad, they harm the economy, they harm the fishery, they harm the ecosystem, and we have ways that we can control them safely and effectively. We get enormous support from elected officials in both countries, but they need to be reminded that these lamprey will bounce back if we ease up on that control.
Mark, I just thank you so very much. You know, these Great Lakes are a great treasure for all of us, and I truly you wonder what's out there in the big lakes, and you've given us a great perspective. Mark, I'm looking forward to you coming back, and we'll talk about other invasive species and how the Great Lakes fishery affects our life here in Michigan and the Great Lakes states.
It would be my pleasure. Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Listeners, you've been listening to Mark Gaydon. He's the Deputy Executive Secretary of the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. I'm your host, Tom Mazur, for Strong Tower Radio Feature. Bye now.